"I'm really enjoying my Bible study group here at Duke," he said. "I wouldn't miss my weekly Bible study group." I asked him, "Were you active in Bible study when you were in high school?" He said, "No, didn't I tell you I was an Episcopalian?" And I said, "Well, I find it interesting that you would come here to college and you would be active in a Bible study group. Why is that?" And he looked at me with exasperation and said, "Dr. Willimon, have you ever tried being like a sophomore and a Christian at the same time? It isn't easy." And that's interesting. Interesting that here, Christians, other religious people, often feel like strangers, aliens, and in the very culture we thought we had created. Or as Leslie Newbegin says, increasing numbers of North American Christians are getting to feel like missionaries in the culture that we thought we had at last created a place where it was safe to be a disciple of Jesus. Or as it was put in a brilliant book, many people today as Christians are feeling like resident aliens. Now, that's interesting. And one problem is, if you're a kind of mainline Christian type person, I don't think we got many resources for feeling like aliens. We don't know how to act on exile. Which is curious because most of Israel's literature, most of the Old Testament, was written during exile. Rules for exiles. Let me tell you a story about Israel's exile. I think you'll find it useful. Once upon a time, there was a king who ruled over the entire world from India to Ethiopia, King Ahasuerus. And King Ahasuerus decided he needed a queen. And so he ordered that the loveliest women from the 127 of his provinces be brought before him so that he might choose the loveliest as his queen. And he chose Esther. Though the king didn't know it, Esther was an orphan. She was a Jew in the care of her uncle Mordecai. Mordecai, to Esther's surprise, advised her, "Marry the king." Mordecai said, "Look, he is not of our faith. He is not of our people. But look, you're a poor nobody. You're a woman. Ahasuerus is king. And in the socioeconomic, gender-based, class-dependent politics of this day, what else can you do?" Now, in the king's employ was a wicked toady named Haman, who wasn't only a bureaucrat, similar to those who work here in the registrar's office or in the Department of Motor Vehicles, but he was a bad bureaucrat, if you'll accept that tautology. Now, Haman plotted to kill all the Jews in all the king's lands because Haman saw these Jews as troublesome aliens who would never be trusted to be loyal subjects of the king. And Haman set a date for the mass execution of Jews. And then, in good, toady, little bureaucratic kiss-up fashion, Haman slithers up to the king and says, "Dear king, it has come to our attention that there is a certain racial, ethnic group in your kingdom who consider themselves above your laws. And although multiculturalism and ethnic diversity is an otherwise good thing, look, a rule is a rule. Allow me to help my king by obliterating them." Well, this sounded like good to the king. After all, a rule is a rule. Ahasuerus agreed and ordered that on the 13th day of Adar, all Jews would be slain. The Jews, of course, were horrified. Mordecai sent news of the plan to Esther up in the palace, begging her to help. And Mordecai says to Esther, he says to her one of the most important lines in the book of Esther. He says, "Who knows? Maybe you have been put in the palace for a moment such as this." Now, a word about palace etiquette here. In those days, it was hard to get to see the king, even if you were a Taiwanese business person with a fat donation. You couldn't get in to see the king. Even the queen had to ask permission to get in to see the king. If she showed up at the office unsummoned by the king, even the queen could be killed right on the spot. Esther reminds Uncle Mordecai of the rules. Queen, bother the king. When he doesn't want to be bothered, you get a dead queen. But Mordecai reminds Esther, "Look, you, young woman, may be the only hope your people have. Who knows? Maybe you've been called to the palace for such a time as this." Esther's in great fear. She doesn't know what to do. She lies awake 3 nights. Finally, she says, "All right, I'll go. If I die, then I die." Esther entered the king's throne room. She was terrified, and yet the king bid her to speak. "Dear king," Esther says, would you grant your queen just one little favor?" "Oh, just name it," said the king. "Even half my kingdom, whatever you want, whatever." She had obviously caught him in a great mood. But Esther faltered, and she was only able to say, "Oh, king, would you and your trusted lackey, executive vice president Haman, do me the honor of attending a great dinner with me?" Well, Haman, when he learned of the dinner invitation, was even more full of himself. So proud he was to be invited up to the big house for a great party. Haman thought, "Oh, surely this means I'm in tight with the king and the queen." Passing old Mordecai on the way up to the palace for the banquet, Haman says to him, "Old Jew, you get ready to swing from a rope by morning." Esther spent the whole next day wondering what in the world she was going to talk to the king about, how she was going to thwart Haman's plot against the Jews. The banquet was a great affair, but Esther all evening couldn't bring herself to speak to the king about her people. At the end of the evening, Esther said that she could only say that the food and the wine has been so great, and the dinner table conversation here tonight has been so scintillating, that I'm going to give another dinner party tomorrow. Would the king and your toady advisor be good enough to come to that dinner? Well, they agreed. And next night, maybe it was the wine or the beef bourguignon, but King Ahasuerus is feeling so good, he blurts out, "Esther, you are a great queen. I want you to tell me, what would make you happy? Anything, diamonds, a palace of your own, whatever." And Esther finally has the courage to say, "Dear king, there is an evil man in your palace who wants to kill me and those whom I love. Let me and my people live. That's all I ask." "What?" said the king. "You tell me who this scoundrel is." And Esther said, "Well, he's right over there, the one with the chocolate mousse on his face." Was Haman shocked? Haman didn't even know that Esther was Jewish. Haman was even more shocked when the king ordered him taken out and hanged on the very gallows that Haman had prepared for old Mordecai. And the story says that is how the Jews have been preserved, even unto this day. A savvy woman, laying aside thoughts of her own safety, speaking up in behalf of her people, she saved Israel from a foreign land. Now, I expect that this is the first time that many of you have ever heard the story of Esther. This is the first sermon I've ever preached out of the book of Esther. The church hasn't talked too much about Esther. For one thing, Esther's a woman. And you know from your courses in history, most of history is most interested in the actions of men. For another thing, some Christians have been bothered by Esther's morality. She begins as a concubine of this pagan king, as his mistress, and eventually works her way into being queen, and that's all rather unconventional. And for another thing, God is never mentioned in the entire book of Esther. God doesn't speak. God doesn't come on the scene. God doesn't intervene. God doesn't do anything. So why should I tell you this story? And on a Sunday, and in church, and on homecoming, and on Founders Sunday. Why would you? Well, because if you're young, then one of your major jobs of being young is to look for appropriate adult role models. If you're young and a woman, your task is tough because there just aren't that many. But if you're young and a woman and you're a Christian, then your choice of adult role models are few indeed. Oh yeah, there are heroes out there. There are great and grand names like Teresa of Calcutta or Madame Curie or Eleanor Roosevelt, but sometimes these great heroes are just, they're out of your reach. Their attainments are just too great. Their accomplishments are just so spectacularly good. How can an average, everyday person like you possibly hope to match your little life with theirs? I therefore point you to Esther. Well, she was a hero, but she was a reluctant one. Eventually, Esther was able to do a great deed for her people, but I want you to note how she took small and hesitant steps on the way to goodness. She assimilated herself into the dominant culture, so much so that most of her people probably thought she had given away the store. She had sold out. She had allowed herself to be co-opted by these pagans so that she was no longer even to be considered a Jew. As a woman, she was powerless, even though she was queen. And yet, and here's my point, Esther used what power she had. She maneuvered skillfully within the confines imposed upon her by her culture. And without fanfare or heroics, she did a good thing. And let that be a lesson to you. She quietly said to herself the words of Mordecai, "Who knows? Maybe I have been put here for a time such as this." What Esther did was not particularly spectacular. But that's good, because most of us are not spectacular. Fortunately, most of the good that God needs doing in this world is not spectacular. Now, someday there may be somebody here who is required to die for the faith that you profess, but not likely. More likely, you'll be given the opportunity or the dilemma of summoning up the courage to speak out, not before the hangman's gallows, but at some elegant dinner party. Or maybe at some business meeting, it'll be you that'll have to put up a good word to the boss in behalf of somebody who doesn't have the voice to speak. See, not large, not grand, not spectacular, just, but good. And today's Founders Sunday. Today, we remember James Buchanan Duke and his spectacular gift to this university, his spectacular vision. But maybe we ought to take some time today also to remember the less spectacular heroes of this place. The professor who in a faculty meeting quietly spoke up for what was right. The president who in the early 1900s stood beside a little professor named Bassett that just in the most modest of ways spoke up for some goodness across the racial divide. We're talking about that kind of goodness that sustains the world, that keeps God's people intact even unto this day. That kind of goodness. This story is about that. Friday night, I was sitting next to somebody at an elegant dinner party. And she is a trustee of Duke. But she was one of the first African Americans admitted to this university. And I said, "How'd you get here?" And she said, "Well, it wasn't by choice. There was this Duke professor, and he was working with my daddy on his PhD. And he said to my daddy, 'Don't you have a daughter who's a high school senior?' He said, 'Yes.' He said, 'She must come to Duke.' And he said, 'She's got other plans.' He said, 'She can change the plans. I'll work on it. This university needs her.'" Just small, just a word here or there, something spoken, and yet this trustee and I agreed the world changes upon such tiny acts of fidelity. This story of Esther is about that. As Christians and as Jews, we live in a world that on the whole neither worships nor obeys God. The motto of this age is not, "What doth the Lord require?" but rather, "What do I have to do to get along?" In such a climate, we are tempted to let ourselves off the hook too easily. It's so easy to say, "Hey, I'm not a martyr, okay? I'm just one little guy. I mean, what can I do?" If it were not for the courage of Esther, we would not have Israel. I'm telling you, this story is for you. In little, ordinary, unspectacular ways, the kingdom of God is being defeated or advanced through us. The whole battle is being lost or won on the basis of our little words, our little gestures and acts. You may be young now, but I'll tell you, someday there's going to be a meeting, and people will be sitting around a big oaken table, and there will be policies being addressed, and you will be required to speak or else sit there in silence. There'll be a joke told in a locker room, and everybody else will laugh at the joke and think it funny. And will you laugh? There'll be a cocktail party, and over martinis, someone will give you a knowledgeable look. And someone will say, "Well, people like us see it this way, of course." And maybe in the back of your mind, you will say, "Who knows? Maybe I've been put here for such a time as this."